This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In light of the recent earthquakes that struck Italy and closer to home, Myanmar, consultant emergency physician and disaster medicine specialist Dr. Alzamani Mohammed Idros is here today to explain disaster medicine, from delivering humanitarian aid during natural calamities all the way up to dealing with medical radiation incidents. Dr. Alzamani, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lin.
So let's start with this. What constitutes a medical disaster?
Well, actually, when we talk about, I would rather use the word disaster medicine rather than medical disaster, because that would mean a disaster in medicine.
You know? Right.
So,
and that can happen anytime.
That can happen anytime, exactly. But when we talk about disaster medicine, nowadays we see disasters every year. Every time when there's a disaster, it involves the injuries, it involves loss of lives. So there is a niche area whereby we need to be focusing our attention to the medical needs during disaster. So it actually has it's actually, even though it's termed as a disaster medicine, it has it's a large area in terms of handling one. In fact, when we talk about disaster medicine, it's about all medical needs that we address during four phases of disaster. Any disaster, we have four phases. The first phase is prevention or mitigation, if we can't prevent it. We try to prevent as much as possible, but in many situations, despite prevention efforts, disaster still happens. So that makes us move to the second phase of disaster, in terms of preparedness. We need to have a program, a plan, drill, simulations in order for us to be prepared to handle any disaster. And then when it actually happens, that will be during the response phase. Whatever we have planned in the past, now we actually execute the plan. This is a very chaotic phase. But if we have practiced in simulations, in drills, it does help. That is the response phase. And finally, once it's all over, everything has been handled, we move on to the recovery phase, whereby we look at how we responded, what we have lost, and how actually we can prevent better. So all our efforts in each of these phases, in terms of medical needs, actually part of disaster medicine. And this involves from the policymakers, from developing standard operating procedures, plans, disaster plans, to simulations, to drills, to actually responding it, to sending a humanitarian team in dealing special situations like chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear and explosions, or what is termed in short as CBRNE. And also our efforts in ensuring there is a business continuity. From a medical perspective, business continuity meaning our services to provide care to people.
With so many different stages involved and with so many different specialties involved as well, I suppose, how do you train as a medical professional for that? I mean, what kinds of skills do you need to pick up in order to be able to participate or to help when it comes to disaster medicine?
It involves multiple agencies. In fact, in medicine alone, it involves multiple specialties. A lot of this disaster, or when we term disaster, we use it the term also in mass casualty incidents. Although they might be slightly different in that. Disaster is much larger. When people term it, it means a sudden event that affects large geographical area and involves the loss of lives, loss of properties, and it affects normal daily activities. mass casualty incidents are quite like that too. But the difference is that in disaster, it takes a very long time, sometimes years, to recover. For example, tsunami, earthquake, those are examples of disaster, floodings. But mass casualty incidents would involve something like bus crashes or plane crashes. Those are mass casualty incidents. So in order to handle this, whether it is a disaster or mass casualty incident, the training involves quite widespread parts. One training is about developing the plan and how we could, always following the phases of how we could prevent a disaster. So this would include ensuring we take measures to prevent, for example, fire, to make a hospital which is safe from earthquake, for example. So this is part of the prevention mitigation, making sure that the pipings, the drainage are good so that we're not going to be inundated by floodings. So part of training is in this standard operating procedure. Part of the training in terms of preparedness, in terms of running simulations, in terms of running drills. And part of training is also in terms of handling the situation when it actually happens, and also how to ensure that there's a business continuity. A lot of these interests are taken up by emergency doctors, because one of the characteristics of emergency physicians or emergency doctors is that you just can't choose the types of illness or the types of patients, and they will come undifferentiated. And this, not just, we don't deal just with patients, but situations. And disaster is one of those that you just can't choose the types of the events, the types of...
You get what you get.
Yes, you get what you get, and you just can't choose. So as you absorb this, you still make something to be in control within chaos. For emergency medicine, largely you see patients in the emergency room, in resuscitation, you're still applying that, trying to be in control despite the chaos happening around. Only that now in disaster, it's a much larger scale. You're trying to be in control, making sure that in this overwhelming undercapacity situation, you are still in control.
And is it important to have a chain of command? Because as you rightly point out, I mean, in the case of a disaster, you're talking about probably absolute chaos.
Correct, yeah. When we design our disaster plan, be it for the hospital or what we do at the site, we use these terms like medical commander, hospital medical commander. At the site, we use the term like on-scene commander, forward field commander. You look at the words used very much like a military. It's very much militarized. Why we do that is just we want to change the mindset, because in military they are very strong with this command and control, which is required in handling the chaos. We talk about all these the C words, like chain of command, control, coordination, cooperation, continuity. Those are the C's that we're trying to get grip of. So when we use, we change our mindset into a military mindset from civilian by using the words of commander and all this, we want people to follow the command and not to question too much.
The last time we had you on to talk about emergency medicine as a whole, you spoke about the importance of triage, you know, of deciding who is, I guess, who has the most pressing needs at this exact point in time, and kind of dividing patients into those categories. How does that happen? What is the difference between triage in an emergency room and triage in the case of a disaster?
When we go to the site, in a disaster or mass casualty incident, you'll be really overwhelmed. Your resources are limited. The ambulances are limited. There's just a certain number of patients who could get on the ambulance, while the rest had to wait. For that, we apply some triage strategies. An example is using a triage system called START. actually START stands for Simple Triage and Rapid Treatment System, whereby when we assess each patient very quickly, we start our triaging by looking. There are three things that you look at when you triage patients, because just like when you start your car, you look at the meter on your car, you find this RPM meter. So you start, there's RPM meter. Actually, RPM is sort of the mnemonic that we use of the things that we measure to see whether patient is critical, semi-critical, or non-critical. So when we look at the R, stands for the respiratory rate, when we see someone really gasping or they're breathing more than 30 per minute, those are already in the critical category of patients. But if they're breathing well, then we go to P. P stands for pulse. So we're checking the pulse by actually looking at whether their nail beds are actually quickly returning to red when we press, or what we call capillary refill. If it gets back, it becomes red again within 2 seconds, that's good. But if it is delayed, then this patient is critical category. And finally, we look at M, RPM. M stands for mental status. So we just ask the patient if a patient can follow a command, you know, raise your hand, wink your eyes. If they can follow command, that's good. But if they can't, that is also considered a critical condition. We love colors. We always put red, yellow, green. Red as critical, yellow semi-critical, and green non-critical. For those who could walk in those large situation, many patients, we call them out. So those who can walk, just follow me. We're going to give medical treatment. If they walk towards you, so these are green category of patients. They're not going to die. They could follow your command. They could stand. They could walk. Now, those who can't walk, they are either red or yellow. And we use this START system to differentiate which is which. Or dead. Yeah.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Alzamani Mohammed Idris, consultant emergency physician, but we're not necessarily talking just about emergency medicine today. Instead, we're looking at disaster medicine, or medicine that happens in the wake of disasters such as earthquakes, such as tsunamis, and that's what we'll be talking about after this, how to coordinate the response to that. If you've got any questions on disaster medicine, give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Dr. Alzamani Mohammed Idris, consultant emergency physician and disaster medicine specialist. And it's the latter half of that we're focusing on today. We're looking at disaster medicine. In other words, how you deliver medical aid during natural calamities. We've seen a lot of that in recent years. And what tools do we have available in the country during disaster response? Would you say that we are prepared?
To say that we are fully prepared, I would say that preparedness and preparation is a process. It is a never-ending process, and we can never prepare enough. We are seeing a situation which is overwhelming our capacity, and this preparation is a process which needs to be done regularly. The tools involved during disaster, we are looking at a system mostly. We have the normal 99 system for any emergencies, and that too caters for disaster. If you have a situation, you call that number, it will lead you to someone taking the call and asking what's the emergency. But you say that you see that there's a lot of flood or there's an earthquake, this building is shaking, there would be appropriate response to that. If it is a small scale, usually a call center will just dispatch one ambulance. But if it involves mass casualty, the call center will coordinate and pool resources and call ambulances to one site to handle the situation. If it is big enough, this information will also be channeled to hospital management, to specialists in the hospital, to emergency physicians, to the hospital directors, to even up in the Ministry of Health chain of command structure. And there will be appropriate response to that, not only the pre-hospital management, but also at the hospital site. We also need to prepare the hospital, because hospitals receive the product of disaster or the product of the mass casualty incident. Patients will land in our hospitals. So we need to clear our hospitals. We have an alert system and we receive that information. If the information is something which is not really definite, because we do receive hoax calls and all kinds of things, we may put our hospital under yellow alert. Yellow alert means we are being informed, we are being prepared, but the bodies are not on the ground yet. But once it's confirmed, we need all the help we want, then red alert will be declared. When red alert is declared, everybody is on the floor. They come and they help share the burden. So we have this alert system. Again, you use colour. We love colours. Emergency doctors love colours. And that's how it's being practiced throughout the country. Anywhere you go, the major responding hospital near the site of the mass casualty or disaster site, they will apply the system of red alert and yellow alert. And when there is a need for a bigger scale of response involving the health department, that will come in. If it involves even a national response, that will come in too, through coordination through the centre in Ministry of Health.
Well, we talk about coordination and the process of preparing. Hopefully, I mean, as you say, we can never prepare enough. But as we continue to do it, you have actually coordinated medical disaster response for humanitarian aid during disasters in the Asian region. So you have experience with this, and you did that for the Malaysian National Security Council. Could you tell us more about that and what you had to do?
I had some experience in coordinating the medical response because our hospital at HKL used to be given this task of rounding up volunteers who are willing to join these humanitarian workers. Actually, this is under National Security Council in the past. We joined forces between government doctors and non-government staff from non-governmental organizations. This may include doctors from hospital, doctors from NGO like Mercy Malaysia or the Red Crescent. They come in together, and my task is more towards the doctors among the Minister of Health hospitals. We got the names who are willing to go, and also to prepare the equipment. At that time, the National Security Council gave us the trust to actually prepare the equipment. So we went to sent our responders to a couple places at that time, and together with equipments. In fact, in one of the places, even we sent our vehicle together to enable our staff to function easier at the place.
Can you share a personal experience of dealing with a disaster and dealing with disaster medicine?
In the past, I used to join humanitarian workers. There are some memorable experiences that I had. For example, in 2003, there was an earthquake in Bam, Iran. I remember it happened 26 December 2003. About 30,000 people died. And at that point of time, I joined Mercy Malaysia and as volunteer. So we ran a clinic there. Apart from that, we also ran a kindergarten because the children there basically didn't have any schools to go. And when we were done with clinical works at that point of time, interestingly, Mercy Malaysia had a clown flown in. And with all the clown garments, I joined the clown as a deputy clown at that time. And we went to this hospital, tent hospital, field hospital. It was the Red Crescent hospital. And we clowned for children who had what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. So these children, they did not speak after the earthquake for months. So what we did, tried to play some music and tried to make them laugh, tried to connect with them. And amazingly, it that helped, that worked. And this this clown that came in, he was actually an engineer. I think you already know him as the Dr. Bubbles. He is doing clowning in Malaysia. Iskandar Shah. He was so he taught me a little bit to do that. And these are some of the things that I would say is a big jigsaw puzzle in handling the this disaster. What treatment could be given? It may be a treatment which involves medicine, maybe treatment which involves surgery, but there's also a psychological part of it that we had to cater to ensure the whole puzzle is complete.
We're talking about disaster medicine today. If you've got any questions, that number to call 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. While we're talking about the psychological component, how do you take care of the psychology of aid workers, of the people who are actually going out to these areas and seeing the bodies and seeing the actual aftermath of the disaster and having to take care of everybody except themselves?
Yeah, true. All these responders, with what they see, with what they witness, with what they experience, they have risk of developing what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. How you know one has PTSD? Usually they have three components of symptoms. You will see in this group of people, they have re-experiencing symptoms. What we mean by re-experiencing symptoms is that they start to hallucinate, they see things, or they have nightmares, as if they are re-experiencing those nasty experience again. So when you ask them, yes, I have nightmare. Yes, I see the water coming. So those are one component of symptoms. The other thing you look at, they have or they manifest these avoidant symptoms. Avoidant symptoms means when you talk to the child, the child would just avoid from talking about that subject. That's a form of avoidance. Or they avoid from going to their home where the incident took place. So this is another set of symptoms. And finally, they have this group of symptoms called hypersensitivity symptoms, meaning that they are very easily stirred. If they listen to a sound, for example, there's one experience tsunami, then they start to be ready to jump, to run away. So even our workers, when they go to the place, although this already post-disaster, they are at risk of that. And it's real. Some of them came back for months. They are having nightmares. So how do we deal with this? From my experience, when we went to places like this earthquake place, we usually have debriefing every day because we need to let everything out, not to have our team members keep everything bottled up in their heart. So we talk about it and we support each other. It's important to have a support group. And even we laugh together. I see humor as a very important medicine, as a very important tool in ensuring the camaraderie of a group, good working dynamics, that you do it and yes, you go through all these painful experiences, but you have someone that you can count on to be with you and around you. So we do ask and we see and we observe during the debriefing if they have these symptoms. And from there, if there is a need for them to get specialized attention, we would actually upgrade them to be seen by our fellow psychiatrists.
It's very sad and it's very unfortunate that disasters seem to be increasingly commonplace. You know, for some reason, it feels as if we're just having a very bad run of, you know, a decade or 5 years. Or did events like 9/11, for example, and the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami, did those give us a different perspective in some ways about humanity? You know, does it change anything about the way we approach medicine or approach caring for our fellow men?
Well, you are asking about two events. One is the 9/11. The other one is the tsunami, the 2004 tsunami. If we recall, or if you live during those periods, you will recall that 9/11 is a man-made disaster. It killed about 2,000 people. There were planes crashing on the Twin Tower in the USA. Following that event, it did change the world a lot. It changed the world in terms of fear, in terms of being obsessed, in terms of phobia, in terms of terrorism, in terms of being suspicion of people. And it's kind of created a new, kind of, sort of a new world order, because people are taking stringent measures. And the response to it can be exaggerated at times. But if you look at it, 2,000 people died during that incident in 9/11. But do we realize that 7,000 of our own people in Malaysia die from road traffic accident every year? People still are reluctant to wear their seatbelts. You know, when they get in the rear seats, nobody wears seatbelts. So that is scary. Just last week, we had a bus overturn, and the passengers didn't wear seatbelts, and that caused injury to happen. So, but the 9/11 was so much of a high-profile incident that there were responses in terms of policies, in terms of these procedures when people were going to enter, and how you are being treated at the immigration counters. But the ones which is not high profile, like what we experience of 7,000 deaths every year, still is not fearful enough to make us to bring about the change. As for the 2004 tsunami, that tsunami on 26 December killed 230,000 people, roughly. It's huge, but it created fear as well. Nowadays, if you go to Thailand to beaches, you will find there's signages that if there is a water, there's tsunami coming, please run up the beach. And there's a siren system. In fact, now with the social media, we are able to know that there's earthquake somewhere and a certain place is at risk of tsunami, that people suddenly get this information even faster than any siren system. So, but we do have hoax information as well. So that tsunami, because of the impact, did cause some precautions by the government and by the people who were ready to run, unlike in the past.
We also, of course, had the Fukushima disaster.
Yes.
And you have experience in developing the medical response for radiation emergency for HKL. Does that mean that prior to this, we didn't have that in place?
But it's general. We have actually a lot of documents from the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. But the informations are bulky, and they're everywhere. It's not together. I believe simplicity. So and colors, yes. So we try to simplify it by putting everything together. So and following the principles in handling radiation situation.
So what would happen in a potential medical radiation emergency?
Yeah, when we face radiation emergency, we are facing a risk of people attending or responding to those people affected by the radiation also being exposed to radiation. So that's the scary part. We don't have large nuclear reactor in Malaysia, but we do have one baby-sized nuclear reactor in Bangi. That nuclear reactor, the size is only 1 megawatt. Very small. It's for research purpose. But we do have radioactive materials in our hospitals because it is used as a part of the treatment for cancers or even for diagnostic purpose. We do have radioactive materials used in industry, in piping industry. In fact, we had real cases that we handled in the past. And and don't forget, we have Straits of Malacca, which is the longest straits in the world. And there are nuclear-powered ships and submarines flying by. And the size is about 100 to 200 megawatt, which is equivalent to a large nuclear reactor. So with all this risk around, we just can't say that we do not have such risk. But there are measures being taken. Like, for example, Malaysia's own Atomic Energy Licensing Board has detectors at strategic places, including airports. So if anybody with emitting radiation coming through the airport, the detector would light up. So we use all this to put together, plus what we would do in treating them. Largely, these people need supportive treatment, but the protective, the safety precautions need to be in place, whereby we use three things as a principle. We call it the DTS principle. D stands for distance, whereby if you are far enough from the source, you'll be safe. T stands for time, whereby you can spend time with the patient, but you limit it so that it doesn't exceed the amount of radiation that you can take. Actually, you and I, we take radiations throughout
every
the year.
Every day, yeah.
Yes, only that a small amount is safe enough. So we can calculate and ensure that it doesn't exceed the limit that we allow.
And you might need to wear a radiation detector just to keep
Correct.
Track.
It's called personal dosimeter that they could actually measure the dose. That's T. And finally, there's a S for shield, whereby we can use, depending on the type of the radiation, whether it's alpha, beta, gamma, we can use either the from a piece of paper, aluminium, or even the plumber. But usually this is useful for alpha and beta, but not for gamma, because gamma travel in meters, and you need actually large thick plumber to actually reduce that amount.
Out of curiosity, you mentioned supportive treatment.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Okay, supportive treatment meaning that if you have, for example, you're downed with infection, lung infection, you give antibiotics if it's bacterial infection, the antibiotic will kill the bacteria and you get better. But when we say supportive treatment, there is no special pills that can cure what has happened to you. So supportive means that we will give fluids if patients losing lots of fluids. We give painkiller if patients are in pain. We prevent infection because sometimes the radiation can cause like a burn mark area. We sometimes even start antibiotics. Sometimes also a growth factor to stimulate our bone marrow to produce our blood cells following the radiation which actually causes it to suppresses it.
What is the difference between supportive and palliative treatment?
Palliative is end care treatment, where patient is going to die. So it's just to keep patient comfortable. So morphine, making sure patient is comfortable, not in pain, but is to facilitate patient to go
right.
off in a comfortable manner.
So supportive treatment is more like trying to support the
yes.
body in healing.
Correct.
But not necessarily giving a direct treatment because there's no silver bullet.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Now, how has consumer technology like mobile devices, Wi-Fi, GPS systems, drones, how does that change the way we deal with disasters?
Yeah. Well, right now, we have social media, and I think it's a big thing. It's as if it is one big government, borderless, you know, billions of people in that government. But it has these capabilities which might be useful. For example, the Facebook now has this feature of marking yourself safe.
Yes.
So I think this was very much used during the Nepal earthquake, and people found it very useful. So do you have families and friends worried sick that you know whether you're all right or not, so you can mark yourself safe. And this is an amazing way to actually for us to track who's for sure we're certain that they are safe. So these features is up there. But another thing is that now our Wi-Fi has a location that we could share our location and all that. The problem is that during earthquake, for example, during disaster, the Wi-Fi doesn't work. The GPS also would be not functioning well. So we're still going to go back into what we can do manually if we can't use the technology. So our response has to cater when this technology doesn't work. So now you talk about drone, amazing. Because at any disaster area or mass casualty area, we need to mark whether it's a red zone against color, yellow zone or green zone. When we say it's a red zone, it's an area whereby you cannot enter unless you're having a protective dressing or equipment or train. So we can use the drone to mark the area. Then outside that red zone, the yellow zone, is the area where which is relatively safe. We would put all the medical commands from various agencies there, the command post, because this is where you will handle your patients. And outside of that yellow zone, the outer part will be your green zone. This is where you have your press, the relatives or VIPs, those who would be best kept there because it's the safest area. So the drones could assist us in doing that.
Finally, to close off, for people who are not specialists, who are not doctors, you know, we are just people who are at risk in some ways of having some disaster strike at some point. What should we be equipped with? What do we need to face a potential disaster?
Okay, there was one course whereby the disaster trainer asked, all of you must have this must know this RBR principle. Anybody knew? And no one rose their hands. And then he made everyone write RBR principle. So then everyone asked, so what's RBR? What does it stand for? And this expert told them, RBR stands for round, baby round. So in a way, it is true because when the most important thing is for you to be safe. You could get away from the area, which is dangerous. That's important. It may be fire, may be a collapsing building, preventing yourself from getting hurt. But there will be other situations whereby you may actually be involved or you are at the area, the incident site. Now, we find that when there is a mass casualty incident, like buses overturned, the ambulances had a hard time going through the emergency lane. The least you could do is to ensure that it is not blocked so the responders could get there well in time. If you really want to help, actually in disaster, we do need help. Sometimes to carry patients and all that, it takes a lot of energy. If you really want to help, you can still help, but ensure that you help and allow yourself to be coordinated and to be commanded so that all the efforts are in a good coordination and it's safer for you.
Thank you very much for coming in today, Dr. Alzamani. I've been speaking with Dr. Alzamani Mohammed Idrus, consultant emergency physician and disaster medicine specialist, and we've been focusing today on disaster medicine. So the RBR principle is what us non-medical professionals should be applying. Run, baby, run. Just reiterating that in case we ever find ourselves in need of it. You are listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.